Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Yeah, all right. I am Hans.
And I am Franz, and we just want to pop your
compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, here we go. Hour two, 888-914-9149. Cyrus, you looked startled when I mentioned the name Alex Jones.
My eyebrows shot up.
I was like, what? What is this story? I have not heard this one. And then
not that Alex Jones.
I was like, oh, okay. Yeah.
A very different kind of Alex Jones.
Whenever you talk about your old friend, you might have to say, Alex, not that Jones.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So anyway, I just wanted to allay any concerns. No, not that Alex Jones. And some people are going to say, oh, you're getting down on Alex Jones. No, I'm not. I'm just saying it's not him. That's not the guy I'm talking about.
It's like anyway. If your buddy's name was Stevie Wonder, and you'd have to say every time, it's like, not that Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
Like everybody knows that name.
Yeah. Or if somebody's talking about their friend Cyrus Simcoe. Oh, not that Cyrus
not
Simcoe.
That Cyrus. There's only one. I've looked.
There is a Saint Cyrus, we found out recently. Some people who are, you know, Google warriors, they let us know that there is a Saint Cyrus, because I questioned whether or not there was one, and there is one. Was one. Well, there is one because he's in heaven. Let's go to Rod now in Eureka, California. Good morning, Rod. Hello, Rod.
Hello there.
I got a bad feeling about this.
Okay. I just said Ote. That was by accident. It really was by accident. Young Thomas, would you please pick up with Rod, line 3, and we'll get him squared away. We'll come back to you. Let's go to Kaylee now in Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Kaylee.
Good morning, Patrick. So I have a question about baptism. Sure. Personally, I was baptized in the Protestant church. Okay. Ever since I found the Catholic Church as truth, I knew that I wanted to receive confession as soon as possible. In RCIA, they recently mentioned that if you are baptized, you can receive confession. But I do believe they were saying even as a Protestant, if you're baptized, you could receive confession. But I've been waiting all this time, so I'm wondering, is that true, and can I receive confession today as like a normal Catholic?
What a beautiful question, Kaylee. First of all, I'm really happy that you're on the journey, and what a beautiful thing. That's great. So, yes, let me just say yes and no. On the yes side of the equation, strictly speaking, the next sacrament that you would receive would be confession, before receiving the next sacrament of initiation, which would be the Holy Eucharist, or confirmation. Sometimes confirmation is administered first, but in any case, the Holy Eucharist and confirmation would be the second and third sacraments of initiation. You already have the first one, which is your baptism. So since you're an adult now, and I presume you were baptized either as a child or at least several years ago, right? You weren't baptized as an infant? Probably?
As a teenager.
A teenager, okay. So regardless of how old you are now, you're older, and so the chances are that between the time you were baptized and today, you have racked up some mortal sins. Most people tend to do that until they mature and outgrow that. But in the meantime, and I don't mean mature like physically, I just mean over a lifetime. But in any case, that's why you're right. That would be the next sacrament you would receive. And you could receive it because you have been baptized. You have the wherewithal in terms of your soul being apt to receive the graces of the sacrament of confession. Somebody who's not baptized couldn't receive those graces, couldn't validly receive that sacrament, but you can. So on the no side of the equation, and I don't mean no like the door is closed. What I mean by this is that the church prefers, whenever possible, that you would have enough preparation so that when the time comes and you're going to be received into the church, you're going to receive the Holy Eucharist, that you will have formally made your profession of faith. You will be officially coming into the Catholic Church. Now, that's not an absolute requirement. So although it is the norm, and the typical parish or diocese would say, yes, Kaylee, enter into the RCIA program, and on the Easter Vigil, you will be welcomed into the church and you'll receive your sacraments. Now, you'll make your sacrament of confession before that, obviously. But in a given situation, if you were to talk to your parish priest and explain to him your level of knowledge and you're firm in your convictions and this is what you want and you've studied, and if he sees that you're ready, he can receive you into the church then and there. You don't have to wait.
Oh, wow.
It's customary to wait, and it's the norm, and most people do, but he has the discretion to say, all right, I can see that you are ready, so come here to the parish on Saturday, I'll hear your confession, and then come to Mass, and I'll give you your first Holy Communion. He could do that, if he wants to do that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's an option worth exploring. Where are you in the process? Have you entered into RCIA yet? I think you said you were in RCIA, right?
Yes, I'm actually supposed to be received into the church during Easter, but yes, I'm in RCIA right now.
Okay. And in that, you're talking about this Easter, right? A few weeks away?
Yes.
Yeah. So, yes, really the answer is yes. If you wanted to make arrangements with the parish priest to go to confession, you could do that. You could do that today. And you then would either wait and receive your first Holy Communion and be confirmed on the Easter Vigil, which is probably the better thing to do, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but even if you didn't do that, you could make your first Holy Communion sooner than that if you thought that was a good idea to do so. But there is a great value in doing these things on that Easter Vigil Mass, because then it's your official entrance into the church, your profession of faith, you're joining the ranks of the members of the Catholic Church, and it's a really beautiful thing. And it's not that you couldn't, but there may be greater and more heightened spiritual, emotional benefits to you to wait a few more weeks. It's kind of like getting married in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't wait to start your married life, and you can't wait to do what married people do. But it's good and fitting to wait and sort of anticipate and be hungry for it, so that when the big day comes, you're all the more, you know, it'll be all the more pleasing and sweet to be received into the church officially that way. But I know I'm repeating myself, but I think I'll just say again, yes, you could indeed go to confession. Just talk to your parish priest. He'll understand.
Okay. Yay. Thank you so much. That is so helpful. And I think that I will wait for the Eucharist for Easter. Like you said, I feel like that would be much better spiritually, but I just want to get all my mortal sins off my chest.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, what a beautiful thing, and what a great thing the Lord is doing in your life, Kaylee. I'm happy for you. I really am. And I'm glad you called, because I wouldn't be surprised if other people listening have wondered the same thing, people who are in your situation.
Right.
Well, congratulations. A little bit early, but congratulations. I'll be there in spirit. I can't be there in person, but I'll be there with you in spirit.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that, Patrick.
You got it. Call again anytime, Kaylee. Thank you. How about Tom now in Burlington, Vermont? Good morning, Tom.
Hi, Pat.
Hey there.
Yeah. So I guess my question is, it's kind of broad, but so I'm a revert Catholic, and
okay.
I kind of just want, like, I guess some advice on kind of how to live out the faith. Okay. You know, I came back to the church in my mid-20s, and now I'm in my 30s. And, you know, I think I've heard polls saying, like, Vermont is kind of one of the most least religious states in America. And yeah. And so, you know, and I grew up here, so that does seem to be kind of the environment. So I guess, like, my question is how I guess, like, kind of one of the things I hear most often is, like, kind of you know, science versus religion sort of argument. But yeah, just kind of broadly speaking, like advice.
As if the two were mutually exclusive. What a, and I know you don't hold this notion, but what a silly notion in the minds of the addled modern secularist who thinks that there's some conflict between faith and reason. Anywho,
yeah.
So what is your plan de acción? What are you going to do, or what are you wondering about doing?
Yeah. So I mean, I still have some friends in from college and even from high school, and you know, most of them aren't Catholic or don't really believe anything really. So it's kind of more like, you know, in some of those relationships and I guess like once I start kind of navigating and Vermont is also very pro-choice. So like that does sometimes come up too. So it's kind of more like how do I guess start having conversations with people that I know and, especially in this kind of hyper, secular environment, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I have some thoughts. Okay. One thing is, number one, keep listening to Relevant Radio, because we'll help you learn not just what to say, we'll help you learn how to say it and all the different programs. Each of the hosts specializes in different aspects of this. So just keep listening to Relevant Radio. Let this be your school of faith every day. And all I ask for is 3 hours of your day. That's all. That's all I need from you. Drew probably wants a piece of that pie, and everyone else wants a piece. All I ask is 3 hours of your day. So if you keep listening every day or as often as you can, you're going to, by osmosis, start absorbing. You probably already have. You'll be absorbing knowledge and techniques, and then you can try them out. I mean, the only way to get good at playing an instrument is to practice and practice and practice, and at first, it doesn't sound so good. I remember when I first started to learn how to play the violin. I'm sure my poor parents had to reach for the aspirin because it probably gave them a headache to hear it. But the more you practice, the better you get. And that has a lot to do with your confidence as well. There are organizations. One that comes to mind is St. Paul's Outreach. And they are a Catholic missionary group. And they train primarily for like young adults. And I think you fit into that category very easily, and their whole focus is evangelization. So they teach people, young people especially, how to do street evangelization, among other things. And a lot of it takes place on college campuses, but not all of it. Some of it takes place in just, you know, generic public locations. So if you wanted to investigate what they have to offer, that might be a way to form yourself more specifically that way. I would encourage you to tap into the resources at Catholic Answers. They've got tracts and articles and books and lots of things over there that you could read to prepare yourself, especially if you're going to be talking, let's say, about abortion, to become prepared to know what to say and what arguments to anticipate. There's so many things that you can do. I wrote a book, How to Do Apologetics. And it gives you kind of the big picture look at what apologetics is. And apologetics is defending the faith. It's not to be confused with evangelization. And it's just a tool. That's all apologetics is. It's just, if you have a flat tire, you need certain tools. I mean, if you had a socket wrench or let's say you had a power drill or a saw, I mean, those are tools, but those aren't the right tools to fix a flat tire. You have to have specific tools to fix a flat tire. And that's what apologetics is. It's a certain set of specific tools that will help you to be able to speak with confidence on a variety of issues. So if you're interested in a book, I wrote the one called How to Do Apologetics, and that'll give you kind of a big picture view. It talks about how to use evidence, how to use inductive and deductive reasoning, how to avoid logical fallacies, how to spot logical fallacies. There are many different aspects of it, but if you want something that'll give you some guidance in the general idea, that might be a resource. Lots of things out there that can help you, but most especially Relevant Radio.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Pat.
You're welcome, Tom. Absolutely. So how about this? Give me a call maybe in 2-4 months and let me know. If you don't mind, I'd be very interested in knowing how this unfolds.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I'll definitely look into apologetics. That sounds interesting.
I think you'll find it very invigorating. Honestly, when people get, as I say, bitten by the bug, it can really be, it can be life-changing for people. It really can. It has to be properly channeled, because obviously apologetics is not a replacement for anything. It's just a tool. Like fixing a flat tire, you need those tools, but it's at the service of much bigger things like evangelization and knowing Jesus. So apologetics is not a substitute for being Catholic and practicing your faith, but it will help you do that. And, you know, as someone once said, you make me want to be a better man. Well, apologetics will make you want to be a better Christian, because you'll see more deeply into the realities of the gospel, and it'll energize you. I predict it will. So give it a try.
Okay. Yeah, sure thing. Thank you.
You're welcome, Tom. Great talking to you. We'll take a break, and we'll come back with more of your phone calls and your emails. Plenty of those, that's for sure. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. I'll tell you that. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Looking for a new job? How about one that offers you opportunities for spiritual, social, and charitable growth? Our sponsor, the Catholic Order of Foresters, is hiring new agents today. Visit relevantradio.com/forester, an Illinois life insurance company not available in all states.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
I got a fever or something like that. I like that cowbell, Cyrus. It's got a good vibe. 888-914-9149. Thanks again for listening. Let's go to Joe in Watertown, Minnesota. Hi, Joe.
Hello, Patrick. I have a question for you. My question is, how much power does the devil actually have? I'm having a discussion with some Protestants, and we were talking about the Eucharist and when it changes from the host into the flesh. They're telling me that's just the devil trying to trick us. Does he have that kind of power?
Well, first of all, their premise is erroneous, so you should dismiss that premise at the outset. No, Jesus himself is the one who said that he is the bread who comes down from heaven, that his flesh is real food, his blood is real drink. He who eats his flesh and drinks his blood will have life within him. He says all those things and much more in John chapter 6. He begins by saying, he who comes to me will never hunger. He who believes in me will never thirst. So the foundation of everything that follows is faith in Jesus and coming to him in repentance. So that's the starting point. But he goes beyond that. And he teaches in the Bread of Life discourse the reality of his presence in the bread and the wine. So far from the devil just trying to trick you, this is the teaching of Jesus Christ himself. And so
I agree with that, but they kind of dismiss sometimes. They just, you know, I don't know if they just overlook that or what, but it seems like that's one of the sections in the Bible they don't read too much. Let's put it that way.
I understand, and I've been down that road many times with good-hearted Protestant folk who just, they, because the Catholic Church is for it, they're against it, and they just don't, they won't accept this teaching. Now, this doesn't mean that the truth can't break through to them. It often does, and many of them wind up experiencing, you know, mind blown. Wow, I now see that this, in fact, was true. One of the things you could point out, Joe, is that in the early church, they taught very clearly the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. I'm going back all the way to, let's say, St. Ignatius of Antioch, who was himself a disciple of St. John the Apostle. He learned the gospel from one of the 12 apostles. And it seems he also knew St. Peter. So he knew personally at least two of the 12 apostles, and he learned the faith from them. Both of them, by the way, were in the upper room when Jesus said over the bread and the wine, "This is my body and this is my blood." So they of all people would know what Jesus meant by that. Did he mean it figuratively? Did he mean it literally? What did he mean by that? Well, they would have known what he meant by that. And St. Ignatius of Antioch is a good early example talking about the reality of Christ's presence in the Eucharist in his writings. The flesh that suffered and died for our salvation. And he even says, if you meet somebody who doesn't believe what we believe about the Eucharist, then stay away from that person. Because as he explains in his epistles, you know, these are the things that came to us from the apostles. And if you meet somebody who doesn't believe these things, he didn't get that from the apostles, but we did. And one of those things is the Holy Eucharist. So in addition to your interpreting Scripture, we all have to interpret Scripture, but we don't rely solely upon private interpretation, as the Bible warns us against in any case. But you can point out, all right, well, that's your interpretation, whatever, but that's not the interpretation that these early Christians received from the apostles. They received the Catholic understanding of this. The reason is because they were Catholic. And for that matter, Joe, if you really want to have fun, point out that this is the earliest example of where we see the word Catholic being used to describe the church in the epistles of St. Ignatius of Antioch. He says, where the bishop is, there is the Eucharist, there is the Catholic Church. So by the end of the first century, beginning of the second century, they were already referring to the church as the Catholic Church, and the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist is visible, and so on. So even though they may gainsay you, it doesn't matter. Just pointed that out. Well, if you want to go with your interpretation, that's fine. But I'm going to go with what the apostles taught and what Jesus taught and what the Bible says. And what they really the only thing they'll be able to do, Joe, is to say, well, you're just misinterpreting that. And then you say, no, you're just misinterpreting that. And they'll say, no, you're just misinterpreting that. And then you say, no, you're misinterpreting that. It gets kind of silly, doesn't it?
But yeah, just stand your ground. It doesn't work universal.
Yeah, it means that after fashion. That's what it means in modern English, universal, or really the literal meaning is for the whole. For the whole. But that's another way of saying universal. So it might get to the point in the conversation where they might say, well, okay, yeah, they use the term Catholic, but it doesn't mean what you think it means by Catholic. You Roman Catholics, they like to put that in there. And by the way, you never have to call yourself a Roman Catholic. It's so redundant. There is only the Catholic Church. You're a Catholic. And not that you did this, Joe, but I hear this all the time. It's almost like some people, I don't know. I don't know why this is, but a lot of people feel as though if you want to stand at your full height and puff your chest out and be fully, truly bold, you're going to say, I'm a Roman Catholic. You don't have to say that. Just say, I'm a Catholic. And that sums up everything. By the way, the term Roman Catholic really became more of an epithet on the part of English Protestants after the time of King Henry VIII, well, that time and beyond. It was a way to try to box in and pigeonhole Catholics by saying, well, you're a Roman Catholic. We are Anglo-Catholics, and they're Eastern Catholics over in the Orthodox lands and things. And none of that is true. There's just the Catholic Church. It has different rites within it. But anyway, I know you didn't ask that. It's just a pet peeve of mine when I hear people talk, well, I'm a Roman Catholic. You don't need to say that. You're Catholic. Leave it at that. So my advice, Joe, stand your ground. Be polite and tactful and respectful and all the things that I'm sure you're doing. But don't let anybody push you around and tell you, well, you're wrong because you're misinterpreting that passage. And I say, no, you're wrong. You're misinterpreting it. And that will stymie people's efforts to put you on the defensive. Thanks for the call, Joe. I appreciate that. I want to share a little story. I've told this many times over the years, and it ties in with what Joe is experiencing with his conversations. If you've heard this before, I hope you like it hearing it again. But if you haven't heard this story, I hope it's helpful to you. So many years ago, in San Diego. This is at the time, I believe I was still working at Catholic Answers. I had 8 great years there at Catholic Answers. Shout out to Catholic Answers. And I think it was during that time, so it would have been early 90s. And I had given a talk on Mary at a Catholic church in North County, somewhere in the North San Diego area. I don't know why I remember that, but I do remember that after the seminar was over, there were 2 Calvinist Protestants who were there, and they, you know, chatting with me at the book table after the event, and they said, you know, we came and listened to your talk, and pretty much everything you said tonight is wrong and unbiblical. And I said, oh? And they said, yeah, if you've got time, we'd love to show you the error of your ways. We'd love to show you why you, as a Roman Catholic, have got it all wrong. And I said, okay, you're on. Let's do it. So I called Nancy. I said, I'm going to be late tonight. I'm going to go have coffee with these guys. So we went to a nearby Denny's, and we sat in the booth. You can picture the scene. The 2 guys with their Bibles are on one side of the booth. I'm on the other side with my Bible. One of these guys, by the way, was a former Catholic, and he was the more aggressive of the 2, interestingly. But these guys were like really hardcore Calvinist, evangelical Protestant, the Church of Rome, as they would call it, is, you know, of the devil and all of the above. So it was one of those kind of things. So I'm there with my Bible. They're there with their Bibles. And I think, as I recall, the conversation began with them saying, as we said, you're like spouting error about Mary, and the Bible doesn't teach that. And that's the problem with you Catholics, is you teach things that aren't in the Bible. And I said, like what? And they said, and then they picked a topic. It might have been Mary's perpetual virginity. And I said, oh, okay. So I flipped open my Bible and I started talking about that topic from the Bible. And then their argument switched from, it no longer was, will you Catholics add things to the Bible? Then their argument was, well, you're misinterpreting that, or you're taking it out of context, and that's not what it means. And I said to them, I'm not misinterpreting this, you are. And their eyes were like, oh, please. And they said, no, you're misinterpreting it. I said, no, you're misinterpreting it. They said, no, we're not. You're misinterpreting it. And I said, no, I'm not. You're misinterpreting it. Now, I'm going to pause here. That's a technique, and it works. And the reason it works is because you, Catholic, you do not have to go on the defensive. Why should you? If a Mormon or a Jehovah's Witness or somebody from Calvary Chapel came up to you and said, you're wrong because you're misunderstanding the Bible, you're under no obligation to say, oh, okay. It doesn't work like that. Just turn it back around. And the reason I say this is a technique is because here's the benefit of using this technique. You turn it back around and just say, no, I'm not wrong. You're wrong. No, 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 no. You're taking this out of context, Mr. Catholic. Oh, no, I'm not. You are. The reason this technique works is because it shows the futility of that argument. It's futile, as if it were somehow proving something, which it's not. But if it were somehow proving just by asserting that you are wrong because, you know, because they say you're wrong, just turn it around and say, nope, you're wrong. Because I say you're wrong. And they'll move away from that argument because it doesn't accomplish anything. It only will accomplish something is if you as a Catholic don't know this technique and you wind up getting put on the defensive. I'm not advocating for rudeness, please understand. But just stand your ground. Okay, point made. Back to this conversation. So we went through this whole, I'm not taking this out of context, you are. I'm not misunderstanding this verse, you are. And it became frustrating, and the more I tried to share from the Bible, which, as a matter of fact, was their earlier complaint. You Catholics never teach what's in the Bible. You go outside the Bible. So I was using stuff from the Bible, and that's where it switched to you're misinterpreting it. So it was frustrating. And we went back and forth and back and forth, and they were ticked off, and I was ticked off, and we weren't getting anywhere. And that's not a good situation to be in, because we should be searching for unity. We should be searching for truth. Jesus wants us to be united in the truth. And so it was not only frustrating, it was probably scandalous in the Lord's eyes. But in any case, it wasn't going anywhere. So finally, and this is the money part of this whole story. So if you don't remember any other part of it, just remember this part I'm about to tell you right now. And use this for yourself, this one weird trick, and you'll find that it really does work. Here's what I did. I took the napkin on the table, and I took the pen out of my pocket, and I jotted down 6 words on the napkin. And if you have a pen handy, write these down. I wrote on the napkin, I never said you stole money. I never said you stole money. Now, I pushed the napkin in front of the two guys, and I said, do you understand what I mean by this? They, yeah, I never said you stole money. I understand it. And I said, are you sure you understand what I mean by this? Of course, we understand what you mean by this. What's your point? And then for dramatic effect, I asked a third time. I just want to make sure. Are you telling me that you are certain that you know what I mean by this sentence? I never said you stole money. And they said, yes. What is your point already? So I said, did I mean I never said you stole money? Meaning somebody else said it. Or did I mean I never said you stole money? I thought about it, but I never actually said it. Or did I mean I never said you stole money? It was the guy next to you. Or did I mean by the 6 words that I wrote on this on napkin, did I mean I never said you stole money? Maybe you accidentally lit it on fire. I don't know. But I never said you stole it. Or did I mean I never said you stole money? Maybe you stole someone's wife. Maybe you stole company time surfing on Facebook when you should have been working. And so I said, you know, did I mean I never said you stole money? Or 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 I never said you stole money? Which of these five very different meanings did I intend by those 6 words written in your presence in our common language of English that we both understand? No big words, nothing complicated. Which of these five different things did I mean by that? Yeah. The look on their faces was priceless because it's like the proverbial light bulb going on over their heads. I could see that they could see the point. And I said to them, do you understand what I meant by these words? And they sheepishly sort of shrugged and said, well, I guess if you put it that way, no, we really don't. And I said, that's all I've been trying to share with you guys this evening. And that is, just because you open the Bible and say, the Bible says, it doesn't necessarily mean that your understanding of the meaning of that Bible passage is the correct meaning. What did Jesus mean at the Last Supper when he said, this is my body? What did he mean by that? He meant something. Did he mean it, you know, figuratively? Hey, guys, whenever you do this, check it out. This little wafer is just going to remind you of me. Did he mean it in that sense? Or did he mean it that this is my body? This is my blood. It's not a reminder of my body and blood, or it's not a symbol of my body and blood. Is it possible that he meant that? It's possible, sure. So the question becomes then, how do you know which is the correct meaning? How can you know if the Bible is just a Rubik's Cube, which I'm going to put it bluntly, is what the Bible became from the time of the Protestant Reformation forward. It was every man for himself. Luther thought he got it right. He had that Rubik's Cube dialed in pretty good. Calvin came along shortly after that and said, well, you know, Martin Luther, you got a few things right, but you got a lot of things wrong. Like, baptism does not regenerate you, Martin Luther. Calvinist had his version of the Rubik's Cube, his version of his understanding of the Bible. The Anabaptists had a totally different, in certain areas anyway, a totally different understanding of the Bible. And those are just the three original branches of what we know today as Protestantism, and they couldn't even agree among themselves. All going by the Bible alone, all looking at what the Bible said, all of them pointing fingers like that Spider-Man meme where there are three different Spider-Mans pointing at each other. That's what it was like. And it's not to say that the Catholic Church didn't have plenty of problems. It did. Still does. It's a messy place. It's a lot like Noah's Ark, but we're not talking about that. The point I made to those guys was, just because you open the Bible and say, the Bible says, doesn't mean that you necessarily are correct in your understanding of what it says. That's all. And it's possible that maybe, just maybe, the Catholic Church might be right. Even though you don't like the Catholic Church, you have to be willing to go where the truth is. So I don't even know if I said those words. I don't remember exactly how it ended, but that's when it ended. So we paid for the coffee and I went home, and 6 months go by. Here's the happy ending. I'm at another event that I'm giving somewhere in the area, and the ex-Catholic Calvinist guy shows up at that event. And he came up to me during the intermission between my talk and the Q&A period. And he came over, big smile on his face, said hello. He says, you remember me? I said, yeah, I remember you. He says, you remember that conversation we had? I sure do. He said, do you remember that thing you did with the napkin and writing those words on the napkin? I said, yeah, I remember that. And he said, well, I just want to say thank you, because that's not what did it for me, but that was like a key opening a door to my locked mind that I just refused to consider the possibility that the Catholic Church that I had abandoned might in fact be correct. So he said, I couldn't stop thinking about that. I never said you stole money. It just really bothered me that I couldn't tell you what you meant by that phrase. And yet I realized I was insisting that I knew what the Bible meant. So he said, I started reading the early church fathers. I started looking at what did they think about these issues? What did the early church fathers have to say about the Eucharist and other things? And he said, that's when I realized they were Catholic. And he said, I came here tonight to tell you thank you, because I've come back to the Catholic Church. And I said, well, what about that other guy? He says, well, he won't talk to me anymore. But he didn't seem too bothered by it. But he made his way back to the Catholic Church. So try that sometime. I've got to take a break. Try that sometime. I never said you stole money. Try it. It works. I'll be right back. This hour is sponsored by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union. Get the best premiums and discounts, all without charging fees, through Mission Insurance Solutions, part of the Notre Dame Federal Credit Union family. Go to yourmissioninsurance.com. That's yourmissioninsurance.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
We're back. Cyrus, I've written down a sentence for you on this piece of paper here. I'm just going to hand it over to you. And I'd like you to read this and tell me what I mean by it. Okay, so I wrote down, I never said Cyrus was a great guy. I'm going to rewrite this. Okay, I'm rewriting it. Okay, here we go. Here's the new one. I never said Cyrus does a great job. Okay, take a look at that.
I never said Cyrus does a great job. I know exactly what you mean by that.
What do I mean by that? Can you tell? Let's go through it. Okay, so I never said Cyrus does a good job. I never said Cyrus does a great job.
You know what you...
I'm not done. I never said Cyrus does a great job. I never said Cyrus does a great job.
This is true.
I never said Cyrus does a great job. He does a great taco.
These are all true.
He does a great skateboard trick. No, I'm just joshing.
You know what you did say?
Cyrus, you didn't do anything wrong.
You also said...
Cyrus, you are the nicest guy. You are a hard worker. You're a good guy. You're thoughtful. You are empathetic. You're very funny. You're all that and more, Cyrus. You're fantastic. You're an excellent producer. I don't care what anyone else says. I think you're okay. This is a deep fake. It's clearly a deep fake.
That's my ringtone for when you call me.
That's a deep fake.
No, I've got all...
You've got some great ideas, Cyrus.
Those things you have said, and I know exactly what you mean.
Well, the deep, I can, well, you know what? You know how I know it's not a deep fake? Because I do believe that. I do.
That's fun.
All right. Six words on a napkin. That's my story, and I'm sticking with it. Let's go to Eduardo in McAllen, Texas. Hi, Eduardo.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning, sir. Top of the morning to you.
Same to you. I have a question. You know, I grew up with the Baltimore Catechism, basically memorized all those answers to the questions. And I've been looking at the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the universal one. And there's some differences that I noticed. And my question is, do they revise the Baltimore Catechism based on the new catechism? For example, the Baltimore Catechism mentions the limbo. And yet nowhere in the new catechism is the word limbo mentioned. It talks about, you know, where do children go when they die and they're not baptized? Or even where do people go that commit suicide? The new catechism basically has the same answer, that they're in the hands of a loving and merciful God. There's a sense, a more hopeful sense in the new catechism than in the Baltimore catechism.
That's true.
So do they revise it? Do they revise it, or is it set?
Well, by it, you're referring to the Baltimore catechism, I think, right? Do they revise that?
Right.
Okay. So the answer is yes, insofar as it has been updated after Vatican II, the editors and perhaps even the bishops, they thought it would be helpful to update this so that it would be more reflective of some of the things that Vatican II enunciated. So I know that update did take place years ago. I'm not aware that there's been any update that would make the language similar to the current Catechism of the Catholic Church that came out in 1988, or in English anyway, it came out. So yeah, those would be examples of where the posture the church has taken on issues like limbo, which is was a very common and I would say very, what's the word I'm looking for here? It's an opinion that enjoyed great weight among many theologians and doctors of the church, and to some extent still does, but the church has shifted its emphasis more now on the mercy of God and telling parents of children who die without the benefit of baptism that they have every reason to hope and even perhaps expect that God will grant sanctifying grace to these children in a way that he hasn't revealed to us. So that's entirely that is a different emphasis in the new catechism than it is in the Baltimore catechism. So although I've never really thought about who might catalog all of those nuances that could be adjusted, it wouldn't be a bad thing if you ask me, if in light of some of the more recent statements like that one by Pope Benedict XVI and also the document that emanated from the Vatican when he was, I think it was during his time as the prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and they issued through the International Theological Commission the hope of salvation for infants who die without being baptized. And that really kind of enunciates the current emphasis that the church has on this, as opposed to just saying, well, they go to limbo. I could see some benefit if bishops were to say, let's revise the, you know, in a good way, without tampering or lessening it or weakening it. Let's update the Baltimore Catechism so that it has these reflections in it. I could see benefit in that. I don't know if it'll happen, but it would be a good thing, it seems to me. I hope that's helpful, Eduardo. Interesting question. I've never thought about that before. Let's go to Catherine now in Pennsylvania. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Patrick. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
I didn't quite hear you. What did you say?
I said, welcome. Good to have you on the program, Catherine. And I can hear you. So what would you like to say?
I wanted to ask you a question. Okay. Years and years ago, a Baptist had told me this. I had a dogwood tree in back of my house, and she told me that the dogwood tree was the tree that Jesus was crucified on, because on the flowers they're pink, and in the center it has a crown of thorns, and it looked like just a crown of thorns, and on each pebble it, and the tree was pink, and on each pebble there was, looks like a drop of blood. Have you ever heard of that before?
I have. I've heard of that, but I know that the Bible doesn't tell us which kind of tree it was that the wood of the cross came from. In fact, it refers to the cross as a tree. There are some passages like in Acts chapter 5 and Acts chapter 10 where it refers to Jesus being crucified on a tree, but certainly it was lumber by the time it was the cross that he was crucified on. But you know, it's sort of poetically true that it's a tree. So in the two or three places in the New Testament where it mentions the Lord was crucified on a tree or hanged on a tree, it doesn't tell us what kind of tree it was. So if we're saying, does the Bible tell us that? No, it doesn't. But does maybe the custom that it was a dogwood tree? Perhaps that may be the case. So there's no way to know with certitude. But it is interesting that the blossoms do have that very interesting appearance of what looked like the nails and the blood and all those things. So it wouldn't surprise me, Catherine, if in God's providence, when we get to heaven, we find out, oh, wow, it was a dogwood tree. And that's why these blossoms remind us of the crucifixion. But then again, it's entirely possible that it wasn't a dogwood tree. Just it's happenstance that the blossoms look that way. I don't know. So yeah, we can only wonder about that.
Yeah, yeah. I was just wondering. I've always wondered about it because every house I ever bought had a dogwood tree on it, and that's what sold me on the house, you know.
That's nice.
The dogwood tree in the back of the house, you know.
That's nice. I bet everyone's going to rush out to the nursery today and buy a dogwood tree and plant it, so they'll have one in their backyard too. That's interesting, Catherine, and I'm glad you asked the question. I've never even thought about that before. Thank you. Let's go to Cecilia now in Pleasanton, California. Hi, Cecilia.
Hi, Patrick. I have a friend, and she's taking Bible classes, and the teacher told them that St. Paul didn't write the letter to the Hebrews. Well, do you have an opinion on that? Do you think it's true?
Well, the traditional view is that St. Paul was the author of the Epistle to the Hebrews, and modern biblical scholarship has called that into question. And not being a Bible scholar myself, I don't really have the firepower to enter into that polemic. There are those who defend the Pauline authorship of the Epistle to the Hebrews, but I, as I understand it, they're very much in the minority. That was the traditional view, and the church fathers, when they commented on the authorship of the New Testament books, they ascribed the Epistle to the Hebrews to St. Paul. So nowadays, it seems to me that the jury is out. The church has not said one way or the other. The church hasn't said definitely it was or it was not. But my understanding is that the majority of scripture scholars have moved away from thinking that this was St. Paul who wrote this. And so they typically now just refer to the writer of the Epistle to the Hebrews because they don't think it was St. Paul. You're free to think it was St. Paul if you wish. There's nothing wrong with holding that view. You can believe that.
Okay.
But if you ever have, you know, if you're ever sitting across the table at a dinner party and on the other side of the table is a scripture scholar, he might try to talk you out of that.
Okay, Patrick. Thank you very much for your answer.
You're most welcome. Nice chatting with you and perfect timing because we have to take another break here in just a minute. So we'll get to that and then we will come back and spend more time with phone calls. It's hard to believe we're almost done with the second hour, but we'll be getting to your phone calls as well. Just a reminder, if you want to send me an email, go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, click on connect and you can send me an email. And more now I'm getting emails from people asking me, how can I send you an email? And I write back to them and say, you just did. This is how to send me an email. Quickly, here's one that comes in from Krishna. And this is one of two or three or four emails that have come in the aftermath of my conversation earlier today about why do some cultures name boys Jesus or Jesus but many other cultures like ours doesn't. Why don't they do that? And a number of people have been quick to suggest what Krishna says. He says, could the Hispanic culture naming children Jesus stem from the Muslim occupation of Spain? Muslims commonly named their children Muhammad. During the occupation, Christians would tend to identify themselves with naming their children Jesus. Just a thought. Well, that's very possibly the reason for it. Thank you. I'll be right back.